This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
You are listening to Joy 94.9. It is Sunday Arts Magazine for once again on a Sunday afternoon, 4 p.m. it is out there. Thank you for listening, and hello, David.
Hello, Brendan Michael Bale.
Let's get
how
the intros
are you?
Out of the way.
We've got to thank Katie for the last show, filling in for Andy on Three Chords and a Truth.
Yes, he had a week. We're having a week off, so yes. If you're listening, Andy, hello out there.
I'm sure he's not. If he's having the week off, he's probably running around doing something extra. I know his sister's in town.
That's right.
Yeah, so yes. That's probably why he's having the day off.
Yes. Yeah. Now we've got a big show planned today, don't we?
As always.
As always, I'll start with my movie review slash discussion. Mm-hmm. Now, we sort of did a bit of a preview of this one last week.
Yes.
It's a film by the name of It Follows. Mm. Now, that sounds ominous, doesn't it?
About stalkers?
Well, kind of, in a supernatural way, David. Yep. So, it's by writer-director David Robert Mitchell. Firstly, get this out of the way, it's a fantastic film.
Right.
But it's one that's causing a lot of chatter, not only in the horror scene, but also in the mainstream. It's got ratings in the 90% plus range in terms of critics, you know, top critics and
Would be rare?
Very rare for a horror film.
Yeah.
Specifically, you know, something that is fresh and new and a little bit challenging, I suppose, especially with the themes.
Yep.
So I think that's a really big thing to happen.
And was it out of America?
It is out of America.
Right.
The main actress, Micah Monro, she's fantastic. She's sort of popped up in a few things over the past few years, sort of littler roles, but definitely sort of popped up on my radar as someone to watch in Hollywood.
Yep.
And she just knocks it out of the park here. She sort of plays, you know, the final girl, like the female protagonist that you do see a fair bit in horror films, but she is not played as a victim. She is a victim, but she's not played as a victim. She's quite empowered, and she gets a lot, you know, she's got a meaty role to get through. So I think that's fantastic.
Good.
And, you know, Eddie.
How scary is it?
It's quite scary. And
I'm not going to see it then.
And it was fantastic because I got to watch the film in pretty much a full theatre.
Right. Also, lots of people's reactions.
Yeah, and it's definitely the way to watch it. It's something like, I know you wouldn't have seen this, but Paranormal Activity, a film like that, where it's kind of, you know, it loses something if you watch it on the small screen, I think. It's something that you should watch in a crowd. And yeah, everyone's kind of feeling the same way. I had two people, you know, one person on either side of me, and they were petrified. And it was affecting me.
Yeah.
It was sort of, yeah, the whole sort of feel of the film was kind of taking over the crowd. Which is exactly what you want from a horror film.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and, you know, in terms of box office, you know, it's not the most important thing about a film, but it does mean if films like this are successful, obviously, hopefully, the quality of other films coming afterwards will sort of increase a bit. And it was only made for about $2 million US, and it's made at least six times roughly that amount already just in the US. So,
Well, do you know what? I think it's important not to just throw money at them just because it's got a good script and whatever. Because every film now is a little bit harder because money's getting tougher and tougher. But I think it's good, and it's good for the filmmakers, and it's good for, at the end of the day, they're going to make more money out of it if they haven't sold their soul to one of the major studios. So I think it's good, and it brings out the best I feel, in a lot of films. Tarantino, he was doing it on a shoestring budget to begin with.
Yep.
And even now, he doesn't get money thrown at him because it is a bit risky, everything he does. But, you know, he has got a following as well.
Well, a gentleman by the name of Jason Blum, he created this production house called Blumhouse.
Right.
And he did Paranormal Activity, and he's done all these sort of very, they call them micro-budgeted films.
Okay.
Very much similar to this. So about $2 million or less.
Right.
And then, you know, they make sure it's quality and something that's going to grab audiences, and they do.
And they'll make money and can keep on making the movies.
Keep making great films. Yeah. And you know me, I love my horror.
Yeah.
You know, I love these films coming along.
So what's the premise of it, just in a nutshell?
Oh, I suppose I haven't really got into that, have I? So basically, as I said, like, there is a female protagonist, yeah, but she's got sort of a group of friends around her. And basically, she sort of sleeps with this gentleman that she's been seeing for a little while, mm, and doesn't go very well. And he, you know, tells her, well, I've had sex with you and now something's going to follow you. And I had to have sex with you so I could get rid of this thing.
Oh.
So there's, it's kind of a parable, sort of a discussion about sexually transmitted diseases.
Yeah.
And even possibly HIV sort of connotations there. So that's the other level. I hadn't sort of talked about that yet. But, you know, a lot of the critics are talking, bringing that up and talking about that and trying to find these sort of really...
Oh, so at the end of the day, you don't really know what he's passed on.
No,
but
no.
She gets a strange feeling or what?
Well, there's it actually manifests itself as sort of a supernatural force that,
right,
is coming after her, but only she can see it,
oh,
and her friends can't.
Okay.
So they kind of think she's going mad.
Okay.
But as the audience, you get to see this creature.
And as a matter of fact, that sounds fun.
Well, it is, yeah, fun, and it's one of those sort of, as I said, kind of a crowd film. We can go out and get, you know, scared, witless, and but laugh about it at the end. But yeah, it does stick with you. It follows you, if you will, David. Now, moving on to another film that I watched. It's actually a documentary.
Yep.
Antarctica, A Year on Ice.
Oh, okay.
Now, it's playing part of the Poles Apart film exhibition / festival at ACME. It's just kicked off, actually, on the 18th of April, running until the 16th of May. And we all know that ACME does some amazing things.
Yep.
But this one is all about the majesty and the beauty of the different poles. So the Arctic and Antarctica.
Oh, so
well,
it's both poles.
Both poles.
Right.
But the documentary I got to check out was about Antarctica.
Right.
And 10 years in the making.
Gosh.
This, yeah. Huge undertaking done to sort of create this... Just a story about Antarctica and what, you know, the humans that live there. It's fantastic, though. It sort of looks into their lives and kind of the majesty, but the monotony of life down there. Mm. You know, you've got cooks, you've got post office people working there, you've got people working on the ice. You know, they've all got their own little stories.
Yeah.
And it kind of traces the huge difference between Antarctica through sort of the summer months where they have sunlight as opposed to winter where they go dark for months at a time.
Right. And do they ship back their waste?
Do you know what? I'm not sure if they do that.
Because
I think they probably would.
That's one of the things that I would like to know a little bit more about, because, you know, because of the conditions there, a lot of people, especially down south, where I hope they're not leaving so much crap behind and just moving on. And if they leave a post, do they pull it down? And, you know,
it's, well, it's hard to know, because, like, what they sort of covered was the fact that there are all these, as you say, posts of basically done by nationality, and they don't interact with each other.
Oh, okay.
You know, Denmark may have one,
yeah,
and obviously they checked out the American one in this documentary.
Yeah.
But yeah, it'd be interesting to know the different practices between them all. But really, the film was just to show off how sort of beautiful and kind of scarily beautiful down there it is, because it's such a harsh environment.
Oh, yes.
But, you know, you kind of get a feeling.
Mm.
It's hard to put into film, you know, it really get across how sort of dangerous it is. But I think the documentary does quite well in that respect. You kind of see the beauty and the danger lurking around the corner.
Well, wasn't there one of the boats late last year stuck there for, and people were stuck on it for about a 3 or 4 or maybe a month until another one came through, and, you know, a bigger one to break the ice to get them out.
To break the ice. Well, there's this speaking of that, there's a beautiful shot of this special barge that breaks through the ice,
yep.
like you're saying, to let the carriages come through then to get the food pumped back into the areas.
Right, okay.
So if that doesn't happen, then they're very isolated. Yes, exactly. Now, you were going to talk about something called Dark Mofo. Now,
yeah.
we're not swearing at you, audience. It is actually an event called Dark Mofo down in Tasmania. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about
it, David? Yes, because of Mona, and you've been to Mona. You went about a year ago, year and a half ago.
Yes.
Now, I haven't been. I can't believe I haven't been down there. But it's running from June 12th to 22nd. Dark Mofo combines ancient traditions with current art forms to celebrate the dark through art, food, film, music, light, and noise. And they really push the boundaries with this. I've seen specials on it from other years. It's been going now for a few years, and it really does very interesting, very left of center, really pushing the envelope a lot. And one of the main acts this time is Anthony the Johnsons. A lot of people that listen to Three Chords and the Truth know, because Andy plays Anthony a little bit, and I went on his show a few months back before we started our show, and when I played one as well, and he said, oh, I played them quite often on the show, and Anthony the Johnsons fits it beautifully. So it's that very torch singer, dark, and it's already sold out. Anthony the Johnsons already sold out. He was actually here also with the Arts Festival about 2 years ago. I saw him at the Arts Centre, and he was amazing. But just letting people know that if you're looking for something really unusual and something really different, and Tasmania, and well, more to the point, Hobart, where it is, and that's where Mona is as well, embraces this, and there's some spectacular events that happen on all the docks, and it's at night time. Cold. It's in June, and it's food, but again done with a twist, and everything about it's really interesting. It's something that I would really like to go to one time. So I look it up. It's called Dark Mofo. That's MOFO, Dark Mofo, and it's down in Tasmania in Hobart from the 12th of June to the 22nd. So just something to keep in mind if you're looking for something very unusual.
Something a bit different. Now, if you are in Hobart or Tasmania, we'd love to hear from you.
Yes.
You can get in touch with us on 0427 joy949, or you can email onair@joy.org.au. But everyone's welcome. We'd love to hear from you out
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely.
And Marcus is on the front desk. 1300 joy949 is the number. You're listening to Joy 94.9. It's Sunday Arts Magazine with David and Brendan.
Joy 94.9.
A lovely track that is Belle and Sebastian, Nobody's Empire, on Joy 94.9. It's Sunday Arts Magazine.
And it is with us.
Yes,
David and Brendan.
Now, who do we have in the studio? We've got a lovely gentleman.
Oh, we have, and it's somebody that's actually from the same building as us.
Wonderful.
If for people who don't know, this building is owned by the Melbourne City Council, and everyone in this building is a community organisation, which means that we're all on cheap rent, because otherwise we couldn't afford to be here, which the Melbourne City Council beautifully look after us in that respect. So, and we're talking to Felix, who's part of the Fringe Festival, and you are producer of it. Hello and welcome.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me along, David and Brendan.
No, it's our pleasure. So tell us a little bit about the Fringe Festival, for if somebody's listening for the first time and don't know Melbourne.
Sure. So Melbourne Fringe has been around for 32 years. I think this is our 33rd.
Mm-hmm.
Our Jesus year. So, long history. It's an independent, open access arts festival, so a multi-arts festival. Happens every year in the spring.
And it's always related with all the Fringe festivals around the world. They're usually linked somewhere along the way, even though they don't have anything to do with it. But the main festival, the main arts, the government-run festival, isn't it?
That's right. We do sit alongside the International Arts Festival. Though our dates don't cross over.
No.
We abut.
Right.
By about a week.
Okay. And when you say Fringe, that's exactly what it is. It's the people who are just getting out there in the arts that want to try somewhere, and why not be part of a Fringe festival?
Yeah, totally. I mean, Fringe means different things to lots of different people, but often that work, I mean, Fringe I suppose, means independent, often edgy, new ideas, sort of contemporary work by emerging artists largely. But we still have fantastic established artists returning to Melbourne Fringe each year to trial new ideas and push personal performance boundaries.
Yeah, well, I was wondering about that. How has that sort of changed through those 32 years? You know, has the sort of dynamic behind the festival changed a lot?
Melbourne has always had an incredibly strong independent arts community, and particularly independent theatre and performance communities. So Melbourne Fringe is maybe a little bit unique as compared to the other fringe festivals in Australia, and that we largely service local artists. It's largely about Melbourne.
Yeah,
artists.
Where the Adelaide one seems to somebody from everywhere else in Australia, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah, and then of course the big one, the Edinburgh Festival, is people from all over the world go to that one.
Oh yeah, and yeah. I mean it's enormous. But Melbourne Fringe last year 400 shows, so a testament to the strength and vitality of that local independent community here.
Before we get stuck into what you're here for, tell us what's your background. Are you a performer yourself? Or
I was for many years before I became a producer, and I certainly cut my teeth in fringe festivals in New Zealand, actually.
Right, okay.
Where I was a theatre maker.
Right. And when you say producer, what does that mean? Because producer means different things in different genres, doesn't it?
It does. So I'm the festival producer for Melbourne Fringe. I suppose I run the artist services and contribute to the artist development programs for the festival, but I also program and produce the festival managed venues and the Fringe Club.
Right, and which the Fringe Club is one of the big things for the festival, isn't it? Because that's where a lot of the performers will do their show and then come and do a special one-off or for a couple of nights at the Fringe Club.
Yeah, and it is a really unique part of the festival because it is free. It's 14 nights of free programming across the festival, and they're really like large-scale, often participatory events that bring artists and audiences together to kind of party and live it up and make more art.
Yeah, and it's also a great networking for those artists who might not meet each other apart from having a few drinks at the bar and just chatting to whoever's next to you. But it's also very important for the festival as well, because it's really the only, apart from other ways of getting money, but it's really important that you guys make money over the bar, isn't it?
It's essential that we make money over the bar, so we strongly encourage you to come for a beer during the festival. But it's also a really great place to be. It's a really fun party, and it's a really safe space for queer people.
Great.
Which we're really proud of.
And in terms of your role, obviously all the acts are pretty much self-produced. Now, as a producer, you know, how hard is it your job to just wrangle those people, though, to really just organise and make it seem like it looks like it's running smoothly?
How hard is it?
Is there anyone that you actually say to them, oh, look, lovey, you know, like, that's just not going to cut it, or do you just let anyone do it?
Look, it's an open access arts festival, but certainly in the Fringe Hub and in my venues, you know, we have some standards and we work pretty hard to keep those standards. And if that means I have to call you as an artist and say, hey, that projector is askew, I might do that. But it's all in the name of art being better and being as good as it can possibly be for an audience.
And you do it with life being so tough now and the corporate dollars are drying up a lot. You rely heavily on major sponsors, don't you? And it's critical for the festival's future, isn't it?
It certainly is. We're very lucky, though. We have fantastic festival partners. Obviously, we're supported by both the state and the city of Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
And a suite of excellent sort of corporate partners.
And how is it this year? You know, if there's anyone out there listening, have you signed, sealed, delivered your sponsors, or there's always room for more?
There is always room for more in the Melbourne Fringe Festival family. Doors are open. Definitely. Yeah, we deliver a range of different programs with different partners, and there's all sorts of ways.
And it's you don't have to actually be involved in the arts to be a sponsor. Law firms, for instance, and accountancy firms, and all different spectrums can get involved because it's actually good kudos for them to be seen helping the community, the arts community, isn't it?
We very much think so, and we know that we have a loyal returning audience who appreciate all of our partners and sponsors for that engagement for those very reasons. But yeah, I mean, you know, people who are listening who want to engage with the Fringe, right now we're kind of building up to a registration for the festival.
Right.
In fact, it is already open.
Right, we'll get to that. We've got some important announcements to do right now.
Now, of course, you are listening to Joy 94.9, and it's Sunday Arts Magazine with David and Brendan.
Joy 94.9.
You are on Joy. It's Sunday Arts Magazine with David and Brendan, and we've got the lovely Felix Preval, producer of Fringe Festival. He's stuck around, David. How lovely is that?
He has. we've changed him to the chair because we know where he lives, so he can't run away. Now, Felix, tell us, why are you here today?
So I'm here today to talk about festival participation.
Right.
So registrations for artists wanting to present work in the festival are now open.
Yep.
So anyone listening in who thinks that maybe they have a great idea for a piece of theatre or cabaret or dance or comedy or visual arts
as well, yeah.
Or special events. We do now have a lot of special community events presented as part of the festival.
Right.
Can jump onto the website, melbournefringe.com.au, and follow the handy links.
Right, okay. So give us some ideas, because you do lump them. There's even furniture, isn't there?
There is indeed. So each year we have a furniture design exhibition called Fringe Furniture, which is, again, an open access part of the festival. So anyone who's working in independent design can submit a work for the exhibition. It's an incredible event. I mean, each year the caliber gets higher and higher. And I think next year is our 30th year, so there'll be extra special celebrations.
Right, right. And it's galleries that you want involved as well for visual arts. You want them to say, hey, I would like to organise an exhibition?
Absolutely. We have a growing visual arts program year by year, and we know that Melbourne Fringe speaks directly to a lot of tourists and families who are looking for kind of daytime activities to do. So, yeah, we'd love to see more and more galleries contributing to the festival.
And automatically, have you just got the venues, or you're also always looking for venues?
Actually, anything can be a Fringe venue, which is one of the fabulous things about Melbourne Fringe. Some of our most popular shows year by year happen in very much non-traditional spaces. Garden sheds, private homes, alleyways,
lifts. I've been to one in a lift. As a matter of fact, one year, instead of playing sort of that music, there were people in the lifts here at Joy, and they would just nod and just play music standing in the lift. It was just really fun, because you know how embarrassing it can be sometimes if somebody starts talking to you in a lift or people don't want to look at each other. What do you do in this case? And the thing is, they didn't interfere. They just stood there and played along in the lift while we went up and down. It was great. And they did it for about 2 hours and then moved on to another building, which they'd organised.
That is very much in the spirit of Melbourne Fringe.
Yeah. But then also at, I think it was at the Town Hall, there was an actual performance within a lift as well that only ran for 5 minutes.
Yep. So the Fringe Hub venues in North Melbourne, Melbourne Town Hall, the Lithuanian Club, and Errol's Theatreette.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a performance in that lift. Oh, there have been performances in every possible nook and cranny of those buildings.
Yeah.
I was going to say, is that the funnest part about the festival, is that you have the opportunity to push the boundaries and sort of, you know, have these performance spaces that are outside of the box or inside a box, wherever you might want to put it. Does that excite you each year?
Yeah, it's certainly one of my favourite parts of programming for the festival, is trying to find new ways and new corners in which to install these, quite often like one-on-one performances or live artworks. And so for an audience member to come along and be part of Melbourne Fringe as an audience member, you might see two or three shows in a night, because you can see a five-minute performance between standard 60-minute ticketed shows.
Yeah. And the wonderful thing about it is there is a judging panel as well, isn't there? So therefore, you are looking for a new, exciting... I know some people that have won it, and as a badge they wear nicely when they are selling themselves to one of the other international or even interstate festivals. Well, I won the best... at the Melbourne Fringe Festival.
Yeah, we do have quite a range of awards, a pretty significant professional development and touring award suite. But then, of course, all of the category awards, which are maybe the most coveted. And yeah, another great reason for potentially participating in Melbourne Fringe as an artist. Though, you know, I think each person taking part in the festival has their own reason for doing so, and those reasons are myriad.
Yeah.
Awards is only one of them.
Yeah, exactly. But what I also love about it is that a lot of people's first venture into putting on their own production, and that is a major step because it can often cost you money, which is, yeah, at the end of the day, a lot of people don't make that money back, but it's that first step that you need to take, and then you're actually part of a festival as well. I think that's important.
We really recognize that, and we do absolutely everything we can to walk first time producers through the full experience. We have an artist development program and a range of resources easily available online, a series of forums which have just kicked off. In fact, if you're interested, again, jump onto the website, but there's a big info session next Tuesday night, mm-hmm. Here on Level 10, 225 Bourke Street.
Which I can hear there's a band playing up there as we speak. Now, the other side of it is, so that's really important, all the artists getting involved, but of course, you couldn't run a festival like this without the volunteers.
That is so true.
Like Joy, if it wasn't for the volunteers, we wouldn't be on air.
No, and each year we have around 200, 250 volunteers kind of take part in the festival, and it's just amazing. I mean, people are coming back doing it year after year. This will be my sixth Melbourne Fringe in various capacities, and there are volunteers who've been there 2-3 times as long as I have, and they come back every year and just have an amazing time. So,
because not everyone is a performer or an artist, but you love the arts and you want to contribute, and this way... It's really good because, in a way, you're seeing a lot of it for free. Well, a lot of it's free anyway, but you're seeing it for free and probably stuff that you wouldn't normally go out of your way to see. But you're actually helping and making the festival work by being a volunteer.
Yeah, we really just could not do it without them. But it's true of the arts across the board. Artists need audiences.
Yep.
I mean, audiences are almost more important.
Yeah, well, of course they are. Of course they are. Everything's on the website. The website is up and running. And if you want to become an artist in this year's festival, you can do that. Volunteer. And, of course, once the program's all set... you'll be off and running, and I'm sure you'll be on Joy talking about it once it's off and running.
I certainly look forward to coming back and filling you in on all of the red hot queer shows this year.
Yeah. Well, not just the queer shows, in any shows. Yeah.
All right. Sometimes my favourites are the queer shows, so I'm pretty excited about them. So the dates, though, registration closes on the 22nd of May. So
that's
people
right.
have got plenty of time to think about, find a venue. But jump online tonight if you're thinking about it, listening in, and start reading that information. And the festival dates, of course, 16th of September
right
to the 4th of October this year. So just as spring has sprung.
Right. Brilliant. Thanks so much for coming in, and we must get you back once the program's announced.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. You are listening to Joy 94.9 Sunday Arts Magazine.
Joy.
Oh, I'm in love with that track, Lana Del Rey. That is called West Coast, the radio edit of that one. And you are listening to Sunday Arts Magazine, and we've got another lovely gentleman come into the studio.
Oh, I don't know if he's lovely. We've spoken to him. Is he that nice?
Lovely, I think so.
Lovely enough.
He's very learned. I know that much at least. Guy Abraham, CEO of Art Plus Climate Equals Change for 2015. Thank you for coming in.
That's absolute pleasure.
Now, we've got so much to cover.
Mm.
Where do we start? Let's talk about your background first.
Sure.
Firstly, how did you get involved with this project? How did you get it off the ground?
Okay, well, that takes me back a little while.
A little while, yes.
Maybe should I go right back to the beginning?
Why not?
Yeah, yeah, tell us who you are.
Chronology is always easy. I studied back when I was youngster arts and law. So I majored in visual arts. I was really interested in the arts. But I got a job as a lawyer working in the entertainment field.
Okay.
Arts and entertainment.
Right.
So I was doing work for musicians, movie companies, writers, advertising agencies, if you'd call that art. But after a couple of years, I sort of felt that I was still being a lawyer. I wasn't really directly involved in the arts. Really what they wanted me to worry about was their money. And I didn't have that closeness. And I was fortunate that my mother, Christine Abrahams, has since passed away, was running an art gallery at that time. It was the mid-late 80s.
Which one?
Christine Abrahams Gallery.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
okay.
Was what it was called. And there'd been a sort of spike of interest in the arts. And I didn't know what to do, what I was going to do. I knew I was leaving the law. And I said, look, why don't I come over to the gallery for a few months? I'll set up your filing systems, because she was a beautiful person and very gregarious and very generous and loved being with people, but her business acumen left a little bit to be desired.
Which happens a lot in the arts too, doesn't it?
Yeah, look, I think most often, and probably thankfully, most people get involved in the arts because they're passionate about it.
Yes.
Not because they want to make money. So that was, you know, that was good. But after I'd been there for 6 months, I found I really actually liked working in the gallery. Mm. And so pretty soon I decided that that was where, I would stay there. And I then continued to work with Christine for 7 or 8 years until, unfortunately, she got ill and died. And then I had to make the decision, was I going to keep going? And I decided, yes, this is what I was going to make of my working life. And I was just so enthralled by the contribution that artists make. I mean, I was mainly dealing with visual artists, but all artists, you know, they're absolutely committed. It's not a question of should they do this. There is no question. That's what they're doing.
Yeah.
So I ended up staying on at the gallery for another 15 years.
Oh.
Where
was the gallery? Director.
It's in Richmond.
Right. It's still going,
well,
is
no,
it?
Well, no, actually, it's not going.
Right.
So, no, I ultimately closed it. So I ended up being at the gallery for 22 years.
Uh-huh.
But I was also always very involved in environmental issues. Also, way back till I was, since I was at university, I was always joining the various, you know, environmental organisations, going to protests against this and that. And so, after 22 years, I decided I'd done as much as I really wanted to in the gallery, and I needed to make some other step. And I decided to go back to university and do some more study. And this was particularly funny in my household because my oldest daughter was going to be starting first year uni the next year and I ended up going to the same university as her.
Oh, she would have hated that.
So, you know, we had these little awkward moments where we'd actually bump into each other on campus.
And would she ignore you?
No, she was very good. She said, this is my dad, meet my friends.
Okay.
In fact, it was all fine until after one lecture I ended up in a pub somewhere having a drink with the lecturer and students, and I spied her across the room. And later that night, she said, "Dad, look, you can go to uni, you go to the lectures, do your work, you know, but you know, please don't go out after drinking. I'll draw the line there." Anyway. So I was inspired to do this course. It's called a Masters of Environment. Sounds like Masters of the Universe, but it's not quite there. Which is a very broad and what they call cross-disciplinary course. So you could take subjects from a whole lot of different faculties. So I did subjects from the education faculty, from science, from architecture, from philosophy. But my central theme was climate change, both looking at the science and looking at the policies and the politics. And so I met some fantastic, you know, some of the leading climate scientists in the world are in Australia, some of the leading policy thinkers, philosophers. So I had fantastic contact with all of them. And that was a two-year course, and while I was there, I was lucky enough to be selected to take place in a project. It's called the Climate Project, which was started by former U.S. Vice President Al Gore, and he came out to Australia.
I remember that, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And he was going to train a group of people, a selected group of people, to give the presentation that he gave in his film An Inconvenient Truth.
Right.
And so I was selected to do that, and that was a sort of long weekend.
Yeah.
And that was also incredibly inspirational because, as is often the case, you know, he sort of appears quite wooden on TV or in films, but meeting him, he was just so generous and warm and and passionate about what he was doing.
Oh, absolutely. I've seen the doco and think he's absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
And it's a shame that he never got to be president because he would have made some incredible changes.
Well, it's interesting. He actually spoke about that and said, you know, on the one hand, if I'd been president, I would have had all that power, but then would I have had the time
exactly.
And, you know, because I have to devote my time to all these things. And he'd sort of, I don't know if it was a rationalization, but he sort of really felt that the right thing had happened because now he could devote his life to this. So that seemed to work well. But there were a couple of things that struck me there. One was that he was gathering, and if you've seen An Inconvenient Truth, it weaves his personal story, his sort of personal life story, with the climate story. And that's one of the things that really engages you with it, that this isn't some abstract numbers issue.
Yes.
It's actually about people.
Yep.
And during a break in one of the sessions, I got together with several other people who were from the arts who were also doing the session. So there's people like Claire Bowditch, the singer-songwriter, and Indira Naidoo, the newsreader she was at that time, Michael Cantor, who was the director of Malthouse. So there's really an interesting group there. And we just sat around chatting, and I said, you know, what's happening in your sort of field of the arts in this area? And none of us could really think of anything. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go away and have a look what's happening. And that sort of was really the spark of the idea to set up ClimArt, Arts for a Safe Climate, as an organisation, to sort of coalesce the arts around this issue, because the arts can engage people on that emotional gut level.
Mm. And so this festival that you're doing, which is not a small festival, we've got the brochures here, and the amount of galleries that are involved in it is astounding. And a lot of them were at the launch the other night, including we're at the Potter.
Yep.
It's a gallery or building?
So it's the Potter Museum. Museum of Art.
That's all right. Of course it is. Museum. Which has got a couple of galleries, or three or four in there, isn't there?
Yep.
And so what you've done here is brought arts together with all the scientists from the university.
Yep.
And you could tell that they're really excited about it as well, isn't it? Because it's taking them not out of their comfort zone, but making stuff work in a different way and making they're more real and for what they're doing.
Look, for the first couple of years of ClimArt, I went around and gave a lot of talks around Australia, talking to artists and arts institutions about the issues. But a sort of pivotal moment was a conference I attended in, of all places, Reno, Nevada. There's a beautiful Museum of Contemporary Art there, and attached to that, there's a Centre for Art and Environment. And they have this triennial conference where they bring together artists and scientists and philosophers. It's sort of a bit more in-house industry, but it was such an inspiring event. And I came away from that thinking, you know, surely we can do something like that in Melbourne. So after thinking about that a bit more, I knew I couldn't do it by myself. And it was about the time that a woman named Bronwyn Johnson, who used to be director of the Melbourne Art Fair and the Melbourne Art Foundation, she'd just retired and she was – not retired – hope she doesn't hear that. She just left the art fair, and I said, look, why don't we put something on in Melbourne? Let's team up. And she came on board. And so that was about 2.5 years ago. And since that time, we've been working to this festival. And the idea is we would go out and talk to the curators and directors of all these galleries. We gave them a briefing by these scientists that I'd got to know and policymakers that I'd got to know while I was at Melbourne University. And then we said, okay, here's the challenge. You've heard what's going on.
Yep.
Go away, curate an exhibition, an event, that will engage with this somehow. And we weren't prescriptive. We didn't say you've got to come back with a slogan saying, you know, stop climate change or anything like that. Artists do what artists do.
Yep.
But give them the information, give them the idea, and you as curators and directors, you form it together, and let's see what happens. And as you just said, you know, 25 of Melbourne's leading museums and galleries came back, as well as places like ACMES, the Australian Centre for Moving Image, curated a series of films with the most amazing range of exhibitions. And on top of that, we invited some key international figures. So the director for the Centre of Art and Environment, William Fox, he's coming out to give a talk. He's just written, I think just almost completed a book called The Art of the Anthropocene. And for those listeners who don't know, the Anthropocene is sort of an informal geological term given to this epoch, and it's Anthropocene, that is humans, are now changing the geology of the planet. So for the first time, you know, humans are a geological force. So yeah. It's sort of pretty scary.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So looking at what are humans doing, not only to the environment, but how are we recording it? What are we thinking about the future? Because if we look back at past civilizations, whether it's Egyptian or Greek or Roman, what do we look at? We look at their art.
Mm. Yep.
That's how we find out what they were thinking. So they're actually putting together an incredible collection of works that are engaging with these issues as a sort of historical record and a mirror to reflect what we're doing. And then there's also coming out David Buckland from the UK. Now, David Buckland has been working in this space for at least 15 or 20 years, but he set up an organisation called Cape Farewell. And their job was also to bring artists or arts creatives into this space. And they started with a series of expeditions up to the Arctic. So they got this amazing sailing ship, went up to the Arctic with people like Anthony Gormley, the sculptor, or Ian McEwan, the writer, or Laurie Anderson, you know, the singer. And said, okay, here's, in a way, sort of a bigger challenge to what we did, but said, okay, this is what's going on. What's going to come out of that in terms of your work? And that project has been going on, and now it's expanded. But he's an artist himself, so he's got a big survey exhibition at the University of Melbourne, and he'll come out and speak. So there's sort of some key international players, which will really, I think, let our arts community here know what can be done.
That's it. Well, we've got, we could talk for hours about this. We will come back with a little bit more with Guy Abrahams, CEO of Art Plus Climate Equals Change, just in a little while on Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine.
Joy 94.9.
We're on Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine. We're nearly finished for the day, but we're still chatting with the lovely Guy Abrahams. Thank you for sticking around, firstly.
Before we move on, we've got to say a big cheerio to Kim.
Oh, yeah, Kim's out there running your reception. Her name's Kim Alexander. Her brother's Peter Alexander, you probably know.
Oh,
so she's
God.
Out there. She might be able to get you some PJs if Peter's listening in. We'll see
she's
what we
waiting
can
do. To us as we
exactly,
say.
Yeah.
So what is... We could talk to you for the next hour. There are so many wonderful stories here. What do you want to achieve out of this amazing festival that you're putting on?
So the idea, I mean, what we really want to do, what I want to do, is get people who are sick of hearing the argy-bargy in politics and economics, who don't know where their way into this issue, which affects us all, don't know how to get involved, come along, see an exhibition, go to a talk, anything. This is personal.
Yeah.
I think that's what I'd say. This is personal. It affects us all.
Yes.
And, you know, we tend to sort of think we'll leave it to someone else. We'll leave it to the politicians. We'll leave it to the economists. Uh-uh. They're not going to do anything unless we feel something needs to be done. And when we feel something needs to be done, we'll let them know and they'll do it. And I think looking at these exhibitions, going to these talks, we've got bike tours through the city. We've got a sustainable architecture tour. 95% of the events are free. So you don't have to fork out any money.
Yeah.
You know, even if you only see one, if something engages with you, we can all remember a play or a film or a photograph or a book that has really had an impact on our life. You might just see that image.
Mm.
And
well, I already have. One of the exhibitions that I saw the other day, a couple of them are stuck with me. You know, they've really stuck with me, like the whale, for instance.
Yeah, amazing.
You know, like, and it's huge.
So that's this beautiful charcoal-drawn whale. Mm. I think it's 15 metres long, so it's life-size, by Jonathan Delafield Cook. And as you walk up to it, that whale's eye is about at your eye level, and it's looking at you.
Yeah.
And you can see written on its skin, you know, its history. And you can see it looking at you and saying, you know, what are you guys doing?
Yep, help me.
What are you going to do? Help me.
I need your help.
I'm strong, but I need your help.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yep. And that's at the Ian Potter Museum, one of the galleries.
That's an exhibition called Nature Revelation.
A beautiful mostly photographic exhibition, that one. Absolutely stunning. So how do you find out more about it? Is there a website?
Yep, there's a website, Art Climate Change. So all one word, artclimatechange.org.
Yep.
Has the full listing of exhibitions, of talks, of public programs. It'll tell you everything you need to know. And come along.
And of course, if you can't remember it, just Google it because it's really important. So just artclimatechange.org is the address.
And quickly before we go, what's the next...
step for the festival? I don't know if you've thought
the
forward,
next step for this festival is tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. I'm driving a caravan into Federation Square, which is going to have a blow up tropical island on top. It's called the Maldives Exodus Caravan Show. It's going to show us what happens to those small island states when the water starts to rise and the storms come in, like they did with Vanuatu. What's going to happen after the festival? Hopefully this will be the first of a number. We'd like to do this every 2 or 3 years.
And thank you so much for all your time and effort on putting this festival together. You've obviously done a hell of a lot of work, so we've got to thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me in, guys.
Well, that's it for us.
Brendan, yes, it's that time. So thank you for you out there listening. And as always, we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. So, Brendan, see you later.
See you later. And stick around for the lovely Marnie Banger with the news here on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.